There wasn't much in Angelfield. A single street whose wooden sign read, with logical simplicity, The Street. I walked past a dozen cottages, built in pairs. Here and there a distinctive feature stood out. A large yew tree, a children's swing, a wooden bench. But for the most part, each dwelling, with its neatly embroidered thatch, its white gables and the restrained artistry in its brickwork, resembled its neighbour like a mirror image. I saw no sign of human life at all till I passed the last cottage and came to a combined post office and general store. Two children in yellow mackintoshes came out of the shop and ran down the road ahead of their mother, who had stopped at the post box. The children swooped and dived around each other as though attached by an invisible cord. They switched direction at random, made unpredictable changes of speed with telepathic synchronicity. They were two dancers moving to the same inner music, two leaves caught up in the same breeze. It was uncanny and perfectly familiar. I'd have liked to have watched them longer, but fearful that they might turn and catch me staring, I pulled myself away. After a few hundred yards, the lodge gates came into view. The gates themselves were not only closed but welded to the ground and each other by writhing twists of ivy that wove in and out of the elaborate metalwork. Over the gates, a pale stone arch sat high above the road, its sides extending into two small single-room buildings with windows. Preparing to walk a long way around the boundary to find a way in, I had only taken a few steps when I came to a small wooden gate set in a wall with nothing but a latch to fasten it. In an instant, I was inside. The drive had once been gravelled, but now the pebbles underfoot were interspersed with bare earth and scrubby grass. It led in a long curve to a small stone and flint church with a lych gate, then curved the other way, behind a sweep of trees and shrubs that obscured the view. With each step, the view widened and widened, until at last the pale mass of stone that was Angelfield House appeared, and I stopped dead in my tracks. The house sat at an awkward angle. Arriving from the drive, you came upon a corner, and it was not at all clear which side of the house was the front. It was as though the house knew it ought to meet its arriving visitors face on, but at the last minute couldn't repress the impulse to turn back and gaze upon the deer park and the woodlands at the end of the terraces. And the visitor was met not by a welcoming smile, but by a cold shoulder. This sense of awkwardness was only increased by the other aspects of its appearance. The house was of asymmetrical construction. Three great bays, each one 4 stories high, stood out from the body of the house, their 12 tall and wide windows offering the only order and harmony the facade could muster. In the rest of the house, the windows were a higgledy-piggledy arrangement, no two alike, none level with its neighbour, whether left and right or up and down, all of it topped with an uneven roofline of towers, turrets and chimney stacks. The windows were empty of glass and the frames had rotted or burned away. What I had at first taken for shadows over the windows on the right-hand side were fire stains, and the birds swooping in the sky above the house were not diving down behind the building, but inside it. There was no roof. It was not a house, but only a shell. Skirting the cold shoulder, I came to the front of the house. Between the first and second bays, 6 broad, low steps led up to a panelled double door. The steps were flanked by a pair of low pedestals, on which were mounted 2 giant cats, carved out of some dark, polished material. The undulations of their anatomy were so persuasively carved that, running my fingers over one, I half expected fur, was startled by the cool hardness of the stone.